Case number 21-1137 et al. Matson Navigation Company, Inc. Petitioner versus United States Department of Transportation and Maritime Administration. Mr. Townsend for the petitioner, Mr. Ross for the respondents, Mr. Burgess for the intervener.
Morning, Mr. Townsend, we'll hear from you.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Lucas Townsend for petitioner appellant Matson Navigation Company.
You can raise the podium if you like.
I'm sorry?
You can raise the podium if you like. There's a button to your right. And we can hear you better if the microphones are closer to your mouth.
Thank you, Your Honor. Lucas Townsend for Matson Navigation Company, and I have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. Since 2015, the Maritime Administration has been awarding a windfall to APL in the form of unlawful subsidies to operate vessels in the Pacific domestic shipping trade. Matson is a domestic carrier whose U.S.-built vessels must compete with APL-subsidized vessels. Matson has repeatedly challenged MARAD's orders for violating statutory prohibitions designed to prevent this grossly unfair state of play, but jurisdictional issues have clouded these challenges. The jurisdictional issues are briefed in the briefs, and with the court's permission, I would like to address the merits issues today.
I'd like to, you to address jurisdiction.
Yes.
Your position now is that the Hobbs Act does confer exclusive jurisdiction to this court? Is that your position now?
Our position is that the best reading, and let me just say at the outset, I think there are reasonable arguments on either side of this issue. The best reading of this court's 2018 decision, the National Association of Manufacturers, and the text of the statute is that the original jurisdiction lies in the district court. That's the best way to read all of these. I will acknowledge that the government has a reasonable position on this point. At the end of the day, my client simply wants judicial review. We're not trying to plumb the depths of the jurisdictional statutes here because we've been trying to get that merits review for some time. But we want to offer up what we believe is the best reading of the precedents. And so I'm happy to address jurisdiction more at length, but we would be delighted if the court determines that it has original jurisdiction for the Hobbs Act.
That was your position back in 2018, right?
In 2018, exactly. We were in this court. We were under a petition filed pursuant to the Hobbs Act. We were told otherwise at that time. We have taken that into account. We've pressed our arguments in the district court, and the district court has disagreed with us, so here we are again.
Can I ask you about a jurisdictional question that is not really brief, which is whether Matson is a party aggrieved within the meaning of the Hobbs Act? Why would Matson be a party aggrieved?
Well, Matson has classic competitor standing.
Well, you have standing, but that's different from whether you're a party aggrieved under the Hobbs Act. We have very specific standards for that. Usually someone has to be a party to the proceedings below. And in this case, there was no way really for Matson to be a party. I mean, Matson filed comments and, you know, papers with MARAD, but it was not in any sense a formal party to the proceedings.
We have been petitioning to be a party in these proceedings because we believe we have a very strong interest in the outcome of these proceedings, but the agency has not allowed us to intervene as a party. So we have a very informal process in which we were allowed to submit a comment, and it was a comment that was really shooting in the dark, because we didn't have the document that we were commenting on, and it changed substantially after the agency.
But I wonder if it's even possible in the context of the informal proceedings here for someone to be a party aggrieved within the meaning of the Hobbs Act.
Well, I think the alternative—
Because that's a jurisdictional, I mean, if, you know, that is part of our jurisdiction. So if Matson is not a party aggrieved, then we lack jurisdiction.
Well, certainly some court has jurisdiction here, some court. I mean, there is a strong presumption in favor of judicial review of agency action.
District court does.
Well, that was the position that we presented below, and you know, that is what we think is the best reading of the precedents. But again, if this court would like to exercise original jurisdiction here today, we would we would be fine with that outcome and simply trying to get judicial review. If I would like to address the merits today, if with the court's indulgence, the 2022 approval order for the Dakar rests on a fiction. It rests on a fiction that there was a vessel under an operating agreement in 2022 called the Agate. There was no such vessel. That vessel had been withdrawn from the fleet. It had been decommissioned, and it had been scrapped years earlier, almost 6 years earlier. In 2022, there was no vessel under an operating agreement. And that
I don't just lay my cards on the table. I don't really find that argument super persuasive. I don't know what basis there is in the text for it. If my car breaks down and, you know, I don't get around for another year until buying another car, I'm still replacing my old car, even if, you know, I sent my old car to the junkyard and it's turned into scrap. I just don't understand how your argument jives with the common sense of the text.
Well, I would suggest that MARAD has itself taken a very similar position with respect to the Saipan. JA 197, note 1, MARAD filed a declaration in which they say the Saipan is not a vessel under an operating agreement when it is ejected from the fleet, and the Saipan was removed from the fleet. A fortiori, when a vessel is withdrawn from the fleet and it is scrapped, it is no longer a vessel. A fortiori, it is not a vessel under an operating agreement.
Those circumstances really are quite different. I mean, the Saipan was no longer a vessel by operation of law.
Well, I
mean, isn't that an important distinction?
We think that it's exactly the same position with respect to the Agate. The Agate was not by operating under law, under the operating agreement, and by reading the statute, it was no longer a vessel under an operating agreement. That is really the same. Now, there was a factual component to it that wasn't present in the case of the Saipan, but that's all the more reason why it was not a vessel under an operating agreement.
So MARAD seems to take the position that under an operating agreement just means the vessel that's mentioned in the operating agreement. And that's the Agate. Why isn't that correct?
The operating agreement that they point to is a 2015 operating agreement. Sure, the Agate was in existence in 2015. It was in the fleet. There is no basis for saying
that. But that's not their basis for saying it's under an agreement. They're saying it's the one that's named in the agreement.
They're deeming that to be the operating agreement.
It's not the one that's in the agreement?
In 2022. Well, we submit that there was no vessel under an operating agreement. There had been a vessel in the meantime, the Saipan.
So you're not really addressing the argument, which is under an agreement is just the one that's in the agreement. Why is that not correct?
Well, there has to be a vessel, and it has to be subject to legal force under an agreement. That contract from 2015 had no legal force on the Agate in 2022. The Agate did not exist any longer. That contract, the agency is just deeming that to be the contract in 2022. Ignoring the fact that there was another vessel.
Okay. I'll just try one more time, because each time I ask you this, you go to a different interpretation. I'm just saying, what's wrong with MARAD's interpretation and why is it not reasonable? They're saying under an operating agreement, there's no verb in that. They're just saying it's the vessel that's named in the agreement. What's wrong with that interpretation? Without going to your interpretation, what's wrong with their interpretation?
It's a fiction, and it allows for fictions. Under that view, it could say the RMS Titanic, and that would still be the basis for a replacement. And there is no way that Congress did not want that. Congress spoke in 2018 in response to MARAD's actions in this litigation, prohibited domestic trade for vessels in the fleet that are receiving these subsidies. And that was a very strong statement by Congress. There is no indication that Congress wanted the agency to employ fictions of this sort to bring new vessels.
But the statute does contemplate periods when the vessels are not operating and they don't get kicked out of the program. We're talking about ships. Ships are not constantly operating and they have to be repaired. They can get sunk if they're called to duty and put into the line of fire. And what you're proposing is a very cumbersome process that is very technical. Like, they have to be continuously operating in order to be replaced. No. That doesn't seem to grapple with the practical considerations of what a ship is.
and the fact that they're not constantly operating.
Not at all, Your Honor, because as Your Honor mentioned, the statute and the regulations provide for gaps in instances where there is a gap. This is not a gap. There is no vessel under an operating agreement in 2022.
But if they're not even built yet.
I'm sorry?
Ships that are not even built yet can be under an operating agreement.
Correct, because they're specified, and there is provision in the statute that specifies what happens in those circumstances. But here, this must be read in the context of Congress's statement in 2018 that vessels receiving these subsidies can't operate in domestic commerce. That has to frame the inquiry here. And this type of a fiction where vessels are withdrawn, either kicked out or withdrawn from the fleet, and there is no vessel in an operating agreement, that would be a new vessel subject to the 2018 prohibition that Congress placed in the statute in response to this litigation. That was Congress speaking in 2018. There are additional reasons why both of these vessels are not properly authorized, in addition to the replacement vessel provision. And it's because they are authorized to engage in domestic trade. The statute says that they are either exclusively in foreign trade, they must be exclusively in foreign trade, or in mixed foreign and domestic trade pursuant to a registry endorsement under 46 U.S.C. 12111. And 12111 is not the least bit ambiguous. It specifies five territories.
But there's a Coast Guard regulation that interprets endorsements to allow trade with the Northern Mariana Islands. And what's interesting to me, counsel, is that your client relies upon the same type of endorsement and the same Coast Guard regulations to trade in the Mariana Islands. So why can your client rely on it, but APL can't?
Well, the agency didn't rely on the Coast Guard regulation. The Coast Guard regulation is not cited in either of the orders under review. So this is not something that the court even needs to deal with. If this is somehow significant, then the agency can address it in orders under review in the first instance. Otherwise, it's barred by Chenery. But on its face, it fails. The Coast Guard does not administer the Maritime Security Program. They are not interpreting the Maritime Security Act. Whatever vessel the Coast Guard might allow to dock at the port of Saipan is not our concern in this case. We're concerned with what vessels are allowed into the Maritime
Security. But if the endorsement lets them go to the Northern Mariana Islands, why are not they in compliance with the statute? They're operating under an endorsement that lets them go to the Northern Mariana Islands.
They first must be eligible to enter into the fleet and receive subsidies.
Well, eligibility just says foreign commerce. You're relying on the statute 105 that's about the operating agreement.
Well, the agency itself interprets foreign commerce to mean exclusively foreign commerce or mixed foreign to domestic pursuant to a regulation.
I'm familiar with that regulation, but is the regulation allowed to contradict the statute that defines foreign commerce?
Well, I would say it doesn't contradict the statute because foreign commerce is just not modified in statute. And so the agency reasonably interpreted it for purposes of the Maritime Security Act to mean exclusively foreign or mixed foreign and domestic. And that goes back.
That's interesting, too, because now you're relying on the agency saying they're reasonable when it suits you. They're not reasonable when it doesn't suit
you. Well, I think it cuts the same way. It cuts against the other side's position as well. They want to rely on a Coast Guard regulation that says nothing about the Northern Mariana Islands and plainly contradicts.
Wait, the Coast Guard regulation, you don't agree that the Coast Guard regulation permits an endorsement to cover the Northern Mariana Islands?
Correct. The Coast Guard regulation, the Coast Guard regulation doesn't even mention the Northern Mariana Islands, but it can't contradict 12111.
Doesn't your client rely on the same Coast Guard regulation in order to trade in the Northern or service the Northern Mariana Islands? It doesn't say explicitly Northern Mariana Islands. It talks about coastwise trade.
My client is not in the Maritime Security Program.
I understand that, but these endorsements are not just for the Maritime Security Program.
Well, the Coast Guard the Coast Guard has no authority to interpret administer the Maritime Security Act. And that is the eligibility for entry into this fleet. That is the issue. That is the issue that MARAD has exclusive jurisdiction over. And they have not relied on the Coast Guard regulation, and they have not.
Will you answer Judge Pan's question about your client's activities vis-a-vis Northern Mariana Islands, whether Coast Guard has essentially your client relies on the Coast Guard's endorsement to do that? Yes or no?
I'm not certain whether the answer to that question for the Northern Mariana Islands. I can address it in rebuttal if that's the case. But again, I hasten to point out that my client is not in the maritime security program. It's not subject to the 2018 prohibition. We're a domestic carrier, U.S. vessels, and we are under the Jones Act. So we are not subject to this program and the administration. The Coast Guard regulation simply does not apply in this context. It doesn't apply, and it can't change the plain text of 46 U.S.C. 12111.
Isn't there a different Coast Guard regulation, though, that your client needs to rely on in order to trade in the Northern Mariana Islands? Because there's sort of a gap about how trade happens with the Northern Mariana Islands?
A different regulation? I'm not sure.
A different provision of what is this number like?
My understanding is that in order to trade in the Northern Mariana Islands, everybody, whether you're in this program or not, needs this endorsement under 12111. This 12111 endorsement is not specific to the maritime security program. Your client is a very active, the most dominant, apparently, carrier to the Mariana Islands. Your client is using one of these endorsements under 12001, which has been interpreted by the Coast Guard to allow trade to the Northern Mariana Islands, regardless of the statutory list, which doesn't include it. And so it was interesting to me that your client would sort of question the applicability of this provision, this regulation, that your client relies upon to do this trade.
But we're questioning the entry of vessels into the maritime security program.
And I understand that,
is the challenge.
But the reason they're allowed to be in the maritime security program as replacement vessels is because they have this endorsement under 12111, and that endorsement has been interpreted by the Coast Guard to allow APL to go to the Mariana Islands. And since your client also does the same thing, it surprises me that you would question the applicability of the Coast Guard regulation to interpret 12001.
Well, the agency again. Two separate issues. The replacement vessel issue is different from the registry issue. So first, they are not replacement vessels.
But it's the replacement vessels that are allowed to trade in the Mariana Islands, because if you're a new vessel, you're not allowed to do that at all.
Assuming that they are replacement vessels, which we dispute, yes.
Right.
You would have to have a registry endorsement. It would also have to be, it would have to have some exception to the coastwide trade provision. But again, this is about the receipt of subsidies under the Maritime Security Program.
Why should 12111 apply differently to APL than it does to your client?
Because MARAD is administering a different statute. It's administering.
Well, I'm just talking about 12111, which is administered by the Coast Guard. Why should it be administered differently to your client versus APL?
Well, I think these are issues that the agency could address had it addressed the applicability of the Coast Guard regulation. It did not do that. It did not address the Coast Guard regulation. Orders under review. If this is an issue, the
statute just says that it has to have a registry endorsement under 12111. These ships have that. And to the extent you go further, you're the ones who are saying, but what 12111 allows, or what that registry endorsement allows, should not include the Mariana Islands, then we have to go to the Coast Guard regulation.
The Congress's judgment was that the statute 12111 does not apply to the Northern Mariana. There's no ambiguity.
Then you are questioning the Coast Guard regulation.
I'm sorry?
Then you are questioning the Coast Guard regulation that says you can go to the Mariana
Islands. If the Coast Guard regulation applied here, we don't think it applies at all. The agency didn't rely on it. If it applied here, it can't change the meaning of the statute. The statute is unambiguous. It mentions five territories, none of them the Northern Mariana Islands.
But that means your client can't go to the Northern Mariana Islands either, because they're operating under a registry endorsement of 12111, which the words of which doesn't include the Northern Mariana Islands. This is why this argument is very interesting to me, because it doesn't seem to be in your client's interest to question the registry endorsements under 12111 going to the Mariana Islands. Your client needs that to go to the Mariana Islands.
I'm not at all sure, and I can address your honor's question if I have a chance to look at it, but I am not at all sure that the 12111 registry endorsement is the basis for my client to
I think it is, counsel.
But in this context, the Maritime Security Program is administered by MARAD to receive allow vessels to receive subsidies in this program. It is a different context, which Congress has spoken very clearly about the limits of domestic trade for vessels that are receiving these subsidies. That frames the issue quite differently from a Jones Act carrier providing trade to the Northern Mariana Islands. Quite a different situation. I see I'm over my time.
Why do we need to reach this issue with respect to a vessel that not want to trade domestically? That's was understanding for the Herodite.
I believe it's the Dakar. The Dakar, there's an argument that the Dakar does not currently trade with the Northern Mariana Islands, but it has been authorized to trade with the Northern Mariana Islands. And that's the problem. There would be no further agency action needed for the Dakar to start calling Saipan. And the receipt into the admission of the vessel into the fleet, currently receiving subsidies, that is unlawful if the vessel is authorized to trade with the Northern Mariana Islands. Contrary to 12111, independently, it would be contrary to Section 502B of the Covenant establishing Northern Mariana Islands. These are activities of a contractor of the United States.
Why shouldn't we take the position that if and when that happens, you have a right challenge then, but it's not right then?
Well, there's no agency action that's required before that happens. It's the admission into the agency action has occurred. It's the admission into the fleet and the receipt of the subsidies with the authority to provide trade to the Northern Mariana Islands. That is the action here that we're challenging. No further agency action has to happen. And APL takes the position they don't need any further agency approval if they begin calling the Saipan port. So it is right now. The issue is right now. And the agency has simply authorized something they have no right to authorize. The statute prohibits it. Again, I come back to Congress's. Yes, sir.
Oh, Mr. Chubbs, I mean, why did Mattson agree that the challenge to the Guam was moot? Right, because if Mattson believes that the Herodot was unlawful because the Guam was unlawfully approved, then why not maintain that the suit against the Guam approval was still live?
Because
that seems to be the core of the dispute.
I think ultimately the Herodot is unlawfully in the fleet for the same reason that the Guam was. And I think that, you know, the prior challenge, the replacement vessel challenge, is something the court doesn't need to decide in order to find that the Herodot is unlawfully in the fleet. But in 2018 or...
But I mean, is the challenge to the Herodot separate really from the underlying challenge to whether the Guam was lawfully?
It is in one respect.
What is the legal way in which it is distinct?
Well, there are two arguments. One is that it is not a replacement vessel of the Guam because the Guam was not lawfully in the fleet. Your question goes to that issue. The separate question is that even if it were a replacement vessel, it has been authorized to trade unlawfully in domestic trade with the Northern Mariana Islands, and that is the registry endorsement. Issue 12111 and the covenant 12502B, the covenant establishing Northern Mariana Islands. Separate issue from the replacement.
So Mr. Chubbs, I know you didn't seem to really want to talk about jurisdiction, but if we were to conclude that there were no jurisdiction here, then there's no grounds on which we would reach any of the merits, is there?
If this court does not have original jurisdiction, then it would simply address our appeals from the district court's rulings that it had no original jurisdiction. And so we would presumably then go back down to the district court. We would love to avoid that trip. We've been fighting these orders for a long time. So,
but there's nothing left of the merits for us to address.
There would not be, correct, there would not be Hobbs Act jurisdiction over the merits in this instance. If there are no more questions, I'll reserve the remainder of time.
All right. We'll give you some time on rebuttal. I believe we hear from Mr. Ross.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Jason Ross for the United States. The district court correctly determined that the this court has exclusive jurisdiction to review the Marriott orders challenged here because those orders explicitly relied on Section 50501, which is one of the statutes listed in the Hobbs Act to channel exclusive jurisdiction to this court.
Can I first ask you, why is Mattson a party aggrieved here, which is another jurisdictional requirement for us to have original jurisdiction in the Hobbs Act case?
So the government doesn't dispute that Mattson has an Article III injury, and I think...
Party aggrieved is not only about Article III injury. The aggrieved part is, but you also have to be a party.
I agree, Your Honor. I think actually the real answer is maybe a practical one, which is if, say, Marriott had denied one of APL's applications in this case, I think we would all agree that APL would be a party aggrieved under 2344. And it would be quite odd if Mattson would have to follow a different rule under this court's jurisdictional holding rather than APL itself. Because I think that if APL were to challenge an agency decision, it would come to this court. But if a third party who has an Article III injury based on the agency's decision is challenging the same underlying order, it would be quite odd that that order would have to be challenged in district court.
Maybe. I mean, you know, in a case like this where the proceedings are so informal and Mattson files a series of comments, many of which are not really responded to by Marriott, maybe it is appropriate when someone is not a party to the agency proceedings that they have to go to district court first.
I think I have a legal question or legal response as well as a factual one with respect to the problem you posed. The legal answer, I think, is that this court has repeatedly reiterated that consistent jurisdictional rules should apply to different kinds of parties. In the Media Access Project case, for example, it's made clear that when there is a jurisdictional hook to a particular agency challenge, then the whole suit is looped up into the Court of Appeals to exclusively review the case. Second is that Marriott did actually substantively engage with all of Mattson's challenges.
So what if Marriott, so here Mattson asked, you know, can we file? And Marriott said, sure, you know, we're happy to take your comments. And so they did. What if Marriott had said, no, you know, this is an informal proceeding. We don't hear from third parties. There's no way to file comments in this type of proceeding. Would Mattson be a party aggrieved?
I think so. And I will say for the court's edification, that is what happened in the 2018 challenge. So basically Marriott.
They didn't think that, you know, the court didn't address party aggrieved in that case.
Right.
But so would Hobbs Act jurisdiction, I mean, it's hard to see if they file no comments and have no participation below under our case law. It's hard to imagine how they could be a party aggrieved.
I think I will just return to my answer before that. It would be quite odd that party aggrieved means one thing for participants in the program and another
Then that reads out party, right? Because if Mattson didn't participate below, they would really in no sense be a party. That would read party out of the Hobbs Act. And we have a long line of case law saying party is important. It's not just a person aggrieved, you know, as in the APA. You have to be a party in some sense.
I guess so that would read party narrowly to suggest only parties before the agency itself.
Well, I think that's what our case law says, that you have to have participated in some way.
But that's also true in this case, right? That Mattson filed extensive exhibits with the agency,
I'm concerned about what the rule would be in a situation where agency proceedings are informal and the ability of someone to participate as a party is sort of at the grace of the agency. Mm-hmm. So if Mattson's not allowed to file comments, then they're not a party aggrieved. And if they're allowed to file comments, just sort of based on whatever Marriott decides in that particular informal case, then they become a party aggrieved. And it seems strange that our Hobbs Act jurisdiction would turn on such a distinction. There are almost no cases addressing a circumstance like this where the underlying agency proceedings are informal.
You're right, Your Honor. But I think that's why party aggrieved here should be read to include Mattson, who did participate for the agency.
Oh, why?
Because they are aggrieved by the agency's decision.
They're aggrieved. But my question is not about whether they're aggrieved. I think competitor standing here is reasonable.
Right.
But are they a party? You know, so maybe they can challenge this in district court, right? But they don't get to be a party aggrieved under.
I don't know what to say further, Your Honor, except that it seems natural to apply the same rule to participants in the program and to people who challenge.
It's not what our case law says, though, right? I mean, we have a series of cases, including a number of recent cases, and that's not the standard for what a party aggrieved is under cases like, you know, Ohio Nuclear Regulatory, which is a recent case, and another 2018 case. I mean,
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm just not familiar with those decisions. As you acknowledged previously, this question was not briefed. I will just reiterate, though, that for purposes of review of agency decision making, the process is very similar in district court as it would be before this court. That is, the administrative record is presented to the court for the court's review. There aren't questions of credibility or witness determinations and the like. So to the extent that there is some concern with procedural irregularities and that sort of thing, that is something this court is perfectly suited to do. And I will just again say that before, if you'd like me to turn to the merits, I'm happy to engage further on the jurisdictional question. But as my colleague mentioned, I think all of the parties here are eager to address the substantive dispute before the court. That said, it would make sense to apply the same definitional rule of a party aggrieved to all participants before an agency, even in an informal adjudication, and that the same rule would apply to someone who is petitioning the agency for a particular decision, as well as a third party who is contesting or possibly supporting that agency decision making. I apologize, I don't have anything further because this question wasn't briefed. But with that, I can turn to first the replacement question under 53105F. I think the most natural textual understanding of that particular provision is that there was a vessel subject to legal obligations at the time that the Dakar replaced the Agata. And it might be useful if the court is interested to zoom out a little bit and understand why we are in the current dilemma that we're in. And that's because in June 2020, the district court vacated the Saipan decision, and roughly a month later, MARAD reapproved the Saipan to participate in the program. Mattson again filed suit, and subsequently, APL applied to replace the Saipan with the Dakar, and that was in June 2021. So at that time, the Saipan was participating in the program, and APL had applied to replace the Saipan with the Dakar. 2 months later, MARAD determined that, in fact, the Saipan was not eligible to participate in the program. It had become too old, essentially. And there are reasons I can get into that, but it's probably not worth that much more confusion. Then 2 months later, in October 2021, MARAD determined that the Saipan couldn't participate in the program and snapped back APL's then pending application for the Dakar to the Agata. At that time, APL was subject to legal obligations under the relevant operating agreement, and MARAD simply determined that the vessel subject to those obligations was the Agata. Now, the agency additionally waived APL's ostensible non-compliance with the operating agreement's terms because the APL itself did not fail to comply with those requirements on its own. It was because of this protracted litigation, in fact, that there was some dispute caused over which vessel was actually participating and plying its trade in the Pacific Ocean. So the agency reasonably determined that it would waive the quote-unquote heel-to-toe provision in the operating agreement so that APL would or could replace the Agata with the Saipan, or excuse me, with the Dakar. If there are no other questions on the replacement vessel, I can also turn to the question of the Northern Mariana Islands. We'll just point the court to...
So your argument is really more kind of factual one as opposed to statutory or interpretation.
There is a statutory interpretation argument as well, Your Honor, and that is because I believe for the reasons Judge Pan identified, the upshot of Mattson's case is that a vessel must constantly be in operation while participating in the maritime security program. And that kind of belies common sense. And Congress recognized as much. 53106D3 provides for gaps in service. 53104C1 provides for breach of an operating agreement. I mean, indeed, 53102B2 specifically provides that a vessel that is yet to be constructed can be admitted to the program. All of this goes to say that there are circumstances in which a vessel is not actively plying its trade that the agency could determine that it could participate in the program.
Is there any limitation to that? I mean, your friend on the other side says, what about the Titanic? You know, if the Titanic was under an operating agreement. I mean, is there any type of temporal or other limitation?
So 53104C3 provides that the agency shall terminate an agreement that, in which an operator is not complying with the terms. And in those circumstances, a vessel operator has an opportunity to cure the breach. But the agency is directed, Congress directed the agency to terminate agreements that are not being, whose terms are not being satisfied. And the agency here reasonably determined that APL was endeavoring to comply with the operational requirements. And in, as I mentioned previously, essentially was at all relevant times here, at least the times when.
So that's within the discretion of the agency to decide.
I think that's part of it. Yes, Your Honor. The textual argument as well, if you look at the phrase vessel under an operating agreement, connotes legal obligations that attach to the vessel itself. It's not a question of what is a vessel, because that sort of singular focus on the vessel itself is instead a question answered by 53-102, which is a vessel's eligibility to participate in the program. I apologize, it's a little bit of word salad with all of the statutory provisions, but that's why this relevant phrase is vessel under an operating agreement rather than simply what is a vessel. And that question is one, that is what is a vessel, was one that the agency answered very long ago with respect to the AGATA's entry into the program.
So can I just ask you another jurisdictional question, the one that is briefed, but I mean, what is the reasoning for us to have jurisdiction under 50501? All right, I mean, if you look at the Mattson 1 case, the 2018 Mattson case, and mm-hmm. the NAM case, it seems hard to see how this is, you know, pursuant to a definitional phrase, which is 50501.
Mm-hmm. I think this court in Mattson 1 suggested that there's a distinction between implicitly relying on a statutory provision and explicitly relying on that such a provision. I realize that's sometimes difficult to discern, but as a factual matter here, that's not a hard question. There are a number of pages, it's JA 157 and JA 479 to 480, in which the agency carefully analyzes whether the vessels would satisfy the requirements of 50501. And that's an important predicate for participation in the Maritime Security Program. Part of the point of the program is to have vessels participate in times of war or national emergency. And so there's actually a really important consideration that the vessels be U.S. citizens as Congress has defined
them. So the Hobbs Act is very specific in terms of listing under which provisions you get,
right.
You know, original Court of Appeals jurisdiction, similar to in the Clean Water Act case in NAM.
In NAM, yes.
Right. And so one of the provisions that's not listed in the Hobbs Act is the replacement vessel provision.
Right.
I mean, if Congress had wanted there to be exclusive direct appeal, you know, to the courts of appeal, then it could have easily listed that, but it didn't list that provision. It lists many other provisions
mm-hmm.
in the same space.
Right.
So does this mean that any determination by the Department of Transportation that implicates the definition of a U.S. citizen under 50501 gives us exclusive jurisdiction?
Yes, I think so, Your Honor. And indeed,
isn't that a very expansive reading then of the exclusive jurisdiction provision in a way that is really in tension with the NAM case?
I don't think so. And in fact, it's worth looking to the first sentence of 2342-4A, which affords this court exclusive jurisdiction to review final rules, regulations, and final orders. I mean, it's that final orders language that's particularly important and which the district court honed in on here, which is that 50501 doesn't actually give the agency authority to issue any orders. And everyone agrees here that the decisions were issued under the authority of 53-105.
So it's quite possible that rules, regulations, or orders, not all of those things apply to all of the provisions under which we might have original jurisdiction, right? So I don't know what an order means pursuant to a definition, right? Like how is an order pursuant to a definitional thing? It might only be for rules and regulations. And there may similarly mm-hmm. be other provisions that are listed, and I haven't studied all the provisions in the Hobbs Act, but some of those provisions may not be susceptible to rules or regulations, but only orders, right? So all three words don't have to apply to every single provision.
So two responses, Your Honor. First, as a textual matter, the Hobbs Act, in listing out many provisions, some of the subsections only say final orders. Others say only rules and regulations. So I think the fact that Congress included final orders when referring to the maritime security provisions, that actually is quite significant. And so then I think the real question is, how do we construe pursuant to?
Well, it's rules, regulations, or orders.
Right.
So it doesn't have to be, again, I don't know. I mean, I don't read all of those things to have to apply to all of the provisions that are listed as a grounds for exclusive jurisdiction.
If not, then the court would not be giving full effect to each of those terms. And so I think that that each of the terms should be read to apply to each of the different statutory provisions listed in each of the Hobbs Act subsections.
I'm guessing that some of those provisions aren't really susceptible to rules or regulations in the same way that the definitional provision is not susceptible to an order.
I guess I don't know, as a matter of fact. I will say that the 50501 determination is one that undergirds a lot of maritime security program orders.
And so wouldn't that be a very expansive reading then of our original jurisdiction?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the extent the court is concerned, I think we can all agree there aren't a whole lot of cases involving the maritime security program. And so it's not as if that there's a Pandora's box is being opened here. Certainly to the contrary, this is a relatively niche area that it would not span the court's jurisdiction, but rather simply give effect to Congress's terms. And I guess I will just point out that this court has also reiterated that in a jurisdictional channeling statute, to the extent that there is ambiguity, you know, in AFL-CIO v. NLRB, it suggested that ambiguity is construed in favor of conferring this court with jurisdiction.
But those cases arise where there is a statute that has a very broad original jurisdiction grant. It's not a statute like the one like the Hobbs Act, where there are specific provisions granting original jurisdiction, like in the Clean Water Act. So I don't think those general cases saying that we interpret the ambiguity to favor, appellate jurisdiction, original appellate jurisdiction, applies in a context like the Hobbs Act.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't the Third Circuit in Canoco versus Skinner hold that pursuant to under the Hobbs Act means acting or done in consequence or in prosecution of anything, hence agreeable, confirmable, following, or according?
Yes, that's right, Your Honor. I will say the government does not rely on Canoco Skinner because that case involved a challenge to a regulation. And in fact, the Coast Guard regulation at issue here.
And I'm not sure that much of the reasoning of Canoco survives the NAM case, because Canoco relies very heavily on policy arguments and, you know, functional arguments about the way this works, which I think are very much undercut by the Supreme Court's decision in NAM.
That may be the case. I will also point to the government's brief in the 2020 Mattson case, which I believe Judge Wilkins was on the panel for that case, which was dismissed as moot. There, we cite a number of decisions from the Second and Seventh Circuits, which explain and give a little bit more meat on the bones to what is pursuant to, usually articulating what is the necessary predicate for the agency's decision, or what is a key legal premise upon which the agency has to rely in order to issue the decision. And those cases only support our theory here that invoking Section 50501 or making a determination that a vessel meets the citizenship requirements is in line with the statutory provision itself and would give this court jurisdiction.
So just sort of considering the very importance of having clear jurisdictional rules, right?
Yes.
Whatever the rule is, so we don't have this type of litigation where people have to go to both courts because they're not sure. What should be the rule in a case like this? I mean, does the agency is mentioning 50501 sufficient? So if they mention that, does that give us Hobbs Act jurisdiction? Does it have to be something more than that, you know, where they're really relying on 50501? I mean, what's the law?
I think clarifying this court's holding in Mattson 1 is certainly sufficient. That is, the agency's reliance on, or that the statutory provision is a predicate for the agency's decision, then it would fall within the jurisdictional channeling provision. There could be some sort of exception for, to prevent agency gamesmanship, such that, you know, citing a provision that is certainly not at issue would not give the court jurisdiction. You know, I understand that concern, and the government is sensitive to accusations that agencies will play games with, choosing the Court of Appeals versus the district court. That, of course, there's a question whether the agencies actually have any interest in doing that. But the point being that there could be an an out, as it were, or.
How is a party supposed to know whether the citizenship determination was a predicate, if that's your line?
So that's for eligibility decisions under 53-102. That's usually a question. 53-102C specifically requires that vessels meet the citizenship.
So since that's required, there had to be. And so then you wouldn't have to necessarily mention 50501.
Yeah, that's why I don't think that mentioning it is a good test or even really very relevant. I mean, it's relevant to the extent that if it's mentioned, then that is some evidence that it's relied upon. Mm-hmm. Who cares if it's mentioned, if whether or not it's mentioned, if it's clear that finding under that statutory provision is ready.
I agree, Your Honor. I suppose that in an effort to ensure that there are clear jurisdictional rules and the agencies are on notice, that element of legal formalism might be helpful in this regard. Because if agencies are required to specifically invoke particular statutory provisions in order to have a jurisdictional channeling statute apply, then that's something that at least they also understand.
So I think relied upon is the better test, but mm-hmm. Mattson 1 seemed to suggest that it has to be explicitly relied upon. It also has to be mentioned.
Right. And so the explicit reliance or the citation, mm-hmm. As well as I think
actual reliance.
Yeah, I think that the court also used the language rest its analysis on. Mm-hmm. And so that also from a substantive as well as formal perspective, I think would be the belt and suspenders approach. I do want to just briefly address the Northern Mariana Islands, just so that the court, at the court's pleasure. So I will just note that footnote 2 of Mattson's reply brief on page 23, they expressly disavow challenging the Coast Guard regulation. I'll also point the court to 46 U.S.C. 2103-2104, which afford the Coast Guard regulatory authority, to oversee registry endorsements. So. Just for the court's awareness, MARAD does not enforce 12111. It merely ensures that vessels comply with that statutory provision. The Coast Guard and Customs enforce that provision. And that's why the government suggested, citing the Collins case, that in these kinds of circumstances in which agencies have overlapping regulatory ambits and there are statutory provisions with cross-cutting implications, that you defer to the agency's expertise-laden decision-making. To understand how all of these statutes fit together. The one key piece that I think Mattson avoided mentioning in the opening part of the argument is 46 U.S.C. 55-101, which generally exempts from the coastwise laws the Northern Mariana Islands. It's that gap between 55-101 and 12-111 that the Coast Guard regulation attempts to fill. And so the Northern Mariana Islands, as an American territorial possession, trade with those islands, that is domestic trade. But 55-101 also generally exempts those islands from the coastwise laws. So the Coast Guard naturally tried to fill that gap by saying that trade with any domestic point in which a coastwise endorsement is not required would be permitted by a registry endorsement under 12-111.
So I have a question about your regulation 46 CFR 296.2, mm-hmm. which defines foreign commerce to include more than what the statute defines commerce to include. So 296.2 includes it mixed foreign and domestic trade allowed under registry endorsement. It pulls that language into this definition, mm-hmm. and then this definition is used under a regulation about eligibility.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
53-102, right?
I think it's 296.11. A vessel is eligible if it's operated in foreign commerce. So the problem is the statute defines foreign commerce differently. It doesn't include that mixed trade business.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just wondering if your regulation is contrary to the statute and therefore invalid.
to the extent the regulation is inconsistent with the statute certainly governs, Your Honor. I don't think Mattson's challenged the substance of the regulation itself either. But I also don't think that their challenge turns on the validity of that regulation. Because even under...
No, they are relying on that regulation to make what, under the statute, is an operating agreement issue into an eligibility issue.
Right. I agree
with that. So they're trying to rely on it, but it seems like this regulation, to the extent that it conflicts with the statutory definition of foreign commerce, cannot possibly be valid.
I think that's right, Your Honor. So this would go to the government's argument that 53-102 requires the vessels be subject to an operating agreement, and that operating agreement provide that the vessels participate in foreign commerce. And then there's a separate question, I think under 53-105, whether vessels in complying with their operating agreement's terms can participate in foreign commerce or mixed foreign commerce and domestic trade. And so I think that the government's primary argument with respect to this Northern Mariana Islands point is that at the time the vessels applied for the program, they satisfied the terms of 53-102 because each of those vessels' operating agreements specifically provided they participate in foreign trade. Agency might...
So you would want to disregard these two regulations that purport to also talk about eligibility. Like, you're just relying on the statute about eligibility, but you have two regulations that speak to eligibility that support Mattson.
I think then the question goes to whether 53-105 is a relevant consideration under for making the initial eligibility decision. And so then...
That's a different argument from these regulations, though. They're relying on these regulations to say this is eligibility, because 105 talks about what you have to have in an operating agreement.
Right.
Yeah, I get that. But they're saying you have these two regulations that import the 105 language into eligibility. So there's not a clean break between eligibility and, you know, the operating agreement itself.
I agree with that, Your Honor. And so to the extent that you disagree with the government's 53-102 argument, I think then it becomes a question of, do the vessels or is the vessels trade in the Northern Mariana Islands consistent with 53-105?
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Absent additional questions, we urge the court to affirm the district court's decisions in 2252-12 and 2252-24 and to deny the petitions for review in cases 21-1137 and 22-1150. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we will hear from counsel for intervener, Mr. Burgess.
Thank you, Your Honor. Brian Burgess for the APL interveners. Given my limited time, I would like to jump to the merits, if that's okay, but to just maybe to follow up on one factual point raised by Judge Rao's questions. With respect to the Herodo, Mattson did not participate in a degree in that proceeding. So government counsel's arguments about its participation as a party necessarily limited to the... So to the extent Your Honor thinks that they are not a party aggrieved, that problem under same facts. And we have taken the position, we're actually the only party that has taken a consistent position on jurisdiction throughout these proceedings, that the action should lie in the district court rather than in the Court of Appeals.
But not on the grounds of party aggrieved.
I'm sorry?
Not on the grounds of party aggrieved.
Right. We don't disagree with the position. The position suggested by your questions on the issue. So turning to the merits and to Mattson's lead argument, which takes the remarkable position that an operator loses the ability to replace a vessel when it becomes inoperable, such as through a casualty or an accident. In other words, that you lose the ability to replace a vessel when it's most obviously necessary. As Judge Wilkins and Judge Pan's questions, I think, alluded to, there's no basis in the statute for that restriction. The statute does not, it refers to a vessel under an agreement, which we and the government understand to be the vessel that was identified under the agreement and is bound by its obligations. There's no implicit requirement that it be currently operating or otherwise seaworthy. And it's contrary to the structure of the statute to impose such a requirement. I do want to address Mattson's argument suggesting that, and I don't know how they justify drawing a line between a casualty or an accident and the facts of this case, but they seem to suggest, well, this is different because the vessel has been inoperable for 6 years. But that's just a consequence, as the government counsel indicated, of the way the litigation unfolded. And function of a vacature of our approval is that it restores the status quo ante. That's well established in the case law. It's a position Mattson itself has taken at other spots in this litigation. Is that reverts things back to 2016 when you had the original replacement. The Agate is the vessel under that agreement at that time. And to Judge Rao's question before, is there any limiting principle to this? Could there be a gap forever? We agree with the position of the government that as long as there is an operating agreement in place and a vessel identified by it, you have a right to replace that vessel. But there are restrictions on your ability to proceed under an operating agreement if you're not going to be operating.
Mr. Burgess, what about Mr. Townsend's argument that allowing this type of replacement is inconsistent with the 2018? Statute that Congress enacted. I mean, Mr. Townsend takes sort of a broader purposivist type of view of that statute, that it's sort of designed to limit what Mattson views as a kind of rent seeking.
Sure. I mean, a few responses to that. One, counsel indicated that was passed in response to this litigation. I have no idea what his basis for that is. There's nothing in the legislative history that suggests that. In any event, in 2018 precedes this controversy about replacement. There was a controversy at the time about what the proper scope of service would be authorized. So I don't see how that statute can be read to address this issue, particularly because it did not anyway amend or affect the operative provision about replacement rights. It placed service restrictions on new entrants to the program, but did not in any way change when you can get a replacement vessel. So I think it would be an odd reading of that provision to modify the pre-existing 53-105F provision that is what actually governs here and determines when you could have it. Placement. Because the reason they're making this argument, of course, is because they care about trying to get the service restrictions under the 2018 NDAA, but their argument wouldn't be limited to that. It would apply across the MSP and really have a disabling effect of participants' ability to replace vessels under the program. If there are any other questions about replacement, I'm happy to address it. Otherwise, I'll turn to the question of service to the Northern Mariana Islands. And a few points on that. One, I do think it's very important, and Judge Pan's questions picked up on this, that there's only one registry endorsement. There's not a registry endorsement that applies to MSP vessels and other vessels, which is what Mattson is trying to argue. They're trying to have it halfway, that a registry endorsement would allow less service with respect to the MSP than other vessels. But there's just no basis in the statute for that type of understanding. The statute, 53-105A, refers to domestic trade allowed under a registry issued under the statute. So there's no basis to provide a different rule for MSP vessels than other vessels. If they actually wanted to attack it, they would have to attack the Coast Guard regulation, but they've consistently declined to do that throughout this litigation. I think Judge Pan's questions allude to why. It's understood that is how this operates, and that is how people, including Mattson in this industry, do operate. As to Mattson's argument that the court can't even consider this because the agency didn't address it, that's just not correct. If you look at pages 280 through 283 of the joint appendix, the agency, and this is the opinion from the chief counsel, addressed this exact issue about the scope of service allowed under registry endorsement. I understand Mattson's argument to be, well, that doesn't count because it was from a different approval order, but it's involving the same question about approval of a replacement under the Agate. It's the same controversy, same parties. It was remanded by Judge Moss specifically to address this open question, and it was done so in a thorough or authoritative opinion by the chief counsel. So the notion that Chenery prevents the court from upholding the agency on that rationale, I don't think is supported, and it would be a very strange rule to require the agency to repeat its analysis about factors that it thinks are not relevant in every approval order. Another, I think, important point to mention from that same chief counsel memorandum, because it addresses the questions we're asking Judge Pan about the regulation, which goes to the question of, is it eligibility or is it operational service? The chief counsel, this is at 279 through 280 of the memorandum, addressed the regulation and essentially said that, in this context, where it's going beyond what the statutory definition is, we apply the statutory definition. There's no indication that the agency intended to restrict or expand what the requirements are for eligibility under the MSP. And if you look at the regulations as a whole, if, for example, the definition of an eligible vessel under 296.2 refers specifically to 53-102 rather than 53-105A. So there is some confusion with the regulations. The agency acknowledged that. Judge Moss, I think, called the regulation's confounding, because when you apply that statutory, or I'm sorry, the regulatory definition for foreign commerce, you try to plug it in across the regulation, it just doesn't work. If you try to do it, you'll see it just results in redundancy and gibberish. So the agency, you know, I think in a genuinely ambiguous regulation would be held to our deference that that isn't controlling. But in any event, as the government counsel indicated, even if the court were inclined to think that 53-105A were somehow relevant to an eligibility determination, the service that is engaged in entirely lawful. Judge Wilkins' question about Dakar, although again, we think service to Saipan is perfectly lawful under a registry endorsement, we see no basis to possibly reach that issue here with respect to the Dakar. The agency was clear in its decision that it understood that Dakar was not going to be calling that port. And the argument that
But nothing in the approval prevents it from.
No, that's true, but that's just because. That's just because the approval isn't directed toward it. I mean, the MSP statute is not structured to provide pre-approval to every port you might call. It is just determining whether this vessel is an eligible.
But the agency action is the same. Nothing will change if APL calls on Saipan with respect to the underlying agency action.
That's right. And I think it just goes to show that the question of operating conditions are separate from the determination of whether a vessel is eligible. But to the question of whether there could be an additional action to challenge, I mean, the relevant action, I would think, would be the payments under the MSP program. To the extent we're engaged in service that Mattson believes or that the agency were to determine is contrary to an operating agreement, that would be the relevant opportunity.
So how would that work? So let's suppose, you know, hypothetical, for the sake of argument, that there's a challenge based on your client not operating consistent with the operating agreement. You're saying that there would be some vehicle for Mattson or some other party to challenge the payments?
I mean, certainly we'll have defenses, and I'm not going to give any of those away, but I do think that would be the relevant agency action, that you challenge the payment as being inconsistent with the statute and the contract that you're engaged in.
What would that mechanism be?
I think it would be an APA challenge, just as they're trying to challenge the CMG here. Sending payments is in itself arbitrary, it's just a country law. Again, we think the service is perfectly lawful. So imagine we might have other defenses that we raise to such an action.
Yeah,
I think that is the proper vehicle. But I think that would be the proper vehicle to be challenging if you're concerned with operating rather than.
Do you think this court is precluded from reaching the question of the Dakar because of the agency's understanding that it won't go to Saipan, or that just as a prudential matter?
I think it's not presented different. In right. I think it's not precluded in this of opining about whether it thinks the service is proper or not, but I don't think it can't be something that was necessary to the agency's decision that's being challenged. The agency said this. You're satisfying the conditions for eligibility under the MSP because you engage in foreign commerce. The suggestion that it implicitly authorized additional trade, whatever the court thinks of that, doesn't determine whether the approval was proper. So it just seems kind of extraneous, I think, for the actual challenge that's being presented in the agency action. The court has no further questions. If the court reaches the merits, we urge you to uphold the agency's decision.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Townsend, I think that you were out of time, but we'll give you 3 minutes on your button.
Thank you, Your Honor. 3 points. First, to reiterate, this is not a case about a gap. There are provisions in the statute that deal with gaps, marine casualties, time spent in dry dock. That's not this case. If that had happened, the agency would have addressed those provisions. That would be the basis for the reasoning here. This is a case about a no vessel under an operating agreement. That's quite different on the situation of a gap. Second, the division between eligibility requirements for the fleet and operation is really very quite illusory. There are, to be sure, are eligibility provisions in 53-102B, but then 53-103 says that a condition for inclusion in the fleet is to have an operating agreement, and then 53-105 specifies what that operating agreement must say. And the agency itself considers trade lanes, it considers commercial viability when it makes the eligibility determination, you can see that at JA-139 and JA-452, where the agency actually considers where these vessels will go as part of the eligibility determination. So the allusion, the argument that anything that has to do with contract compliance is something that can just be addressed later, it isn't correct. It isn't found in the statute. The agency itself recognizes that through its regulations, which 296.11 and 296.2 bring these considerations into the eligibility stage. A third point with respect to the Coast Guard regulation, again, it was not addressed below. There, to whatever extent the arguments present interesting issues, the agency did not address them below. The pages that counsel cites are from the Saipan memo, the memo for the reapproval of the Saipan. The agency later withdrew or vacated the reapproval of the Saipan. We don't know what the agency's position is with respect to 296.1, with respect to 63.17, the Coast Guard regulation. For years, the agency took no position, pointedly took no position, expressly said, we have no position on the Coast Guard regulation. And when they did address it in the reapproval order, the order was vacated. And then the orders under review here, the Herodot 2021 Herodot order and the 2022 Saipan order, don't address it at all. It is not something that the agency addressed in this case, in these orders, and it would be barred by Chenery.
Can you address whether your client is a party aggrieved with respect to the Herodot? Because you didn't participate in the proceedings before the agency with respect to the
Well, we don't think that the participation that we were allowed with respect to the Dakar is really any meaningfully different. It was not a complete participation. We were not allowed in as a party status. So we don't see that as a basis for distinguishing between the two orders. But we are a party agree.
So did you attempt to participate with the Herodot and you were denied?
Yes, we've consistently asked to intervene as a party in these proceedings. In all of the proceedings, and the agency has always said no intervention.
Wait, but they did consider your comments with respect to the Dakar?
With respect to the Dakar, we were allowed to file a comment on an application that we were not allowed to see, an application to replace the Saipan with the Dakar. And then later, after the comments were submitted, the agency treated the application as actually an application to replace the Agate with the Dakar. So it wasn't even the application that we were commenting on, which again, we were not allowed to see. But I would say that we're a person.
So did you submit something on the Herodot, but they rejected it? Or how did you try to participate with the Herodot?
We requested permission to intervene as a party with respect to the Herodot.
And they said no.
And they said no.
But you requested permission to intervene on the Dakar. They said no, but they accepted your comments.
Yes, the court strongly suggested that the agency allow us some ability to speak in the agency proceeding. And so the agency, as a matter of administrative grace, allowed the parties a limited period to comment on the application for the Dakar. And that was in 2016. But I would say,
How can our Hobbs Act jurisdiction turn on that distinction? I mean, because under the Herodot, how can you be seen as a party to the proceeding, where there were no comments even?
I would say that the distinction doesn't actually work as between the two orders, but I would say that we're a party.
And I think if that's right, then you go to district court.
I think we're a party aggrieved to the same extent we would be a party aggrieved under the APA, person aggrieved under the APA.
But, I mean, have you read our party aggrieved cases? I mean, you know, they very much emphasize that party aggrieved is different from person aggrieved. You have to be a party to the proceedings. And we have a Simmons case from 1982 that then Judge Scalia wrote, all the way up to a case that was just decided this past fall, Ohio Nuclear Regulatory Commission, something like that. I mean, so this is a very consistent line of cases. For 40 years, we say you have to be a party to the proceedings.
I can just say that we're trying to make the best of what came before this, including the 2018 decision, where this was not an issue in that case, and it was generally accepted.
The fact that a court doesn't address a threshold jurisdictional issue doesn't make any binding jurisdictional holding on future
points. Point taken, Your Honor. And again, this is just our best reading of.
I think actually the circumstance here makes it pretty obvious why the better rule is in informal agency proceedings, you can't be a party aggrieved.
It is our position that the district court had original jurisdiction. We are just simply trying to get review because these orders have been obscured from review for quite some time and trying. And I just want to leave with the 2018 NDAA spoke very clearly about what's permitted here and what is not permitted. Domestic trade for subsidized vessels is not permitted. And that is the rule that goes back to the 19th century. This 2015 order was a sea change in this area, allowing these types of subsidies for vessels in domestic trade. And so if the court exercises original jurisdiction, we would ask the court to set aside the orders under review.
Thank you. Take the case under advisement.